Well, the hardline leader of the Lebanon-based militant group Hezbollah is calling for fresh protests over that anti-Islam film. But on Friday, one of the Muslim world's first celebrity imams, the Egyptian-based Youssef Al-Qaradi, host of a show on Al Jazeera, called for reason and nonviolence, telling worshippers they were witnessing a clash of civilizations, not between the West and the Muslim world, but within the Muslim world. The schisms and tensions in the region post-revolution run like oil slicks. It's not surprising an anti-Islam video would, like a match, set things off. But what else is going on? Jeffrey Fleischman is here with some answers. He's Cairo bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. He was with us often during the revolution that ousted former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Today he joins us in the studio. Jeffrey, nice to see you and welcome.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Tell us a little bit about some background here. You wrote a story about how a Christian dry cleaning business in Egypt scorched a Muslim man's shirt by accident. And this set off kind of a microcosm of what we're now seeing across the region. What happened?
Well, it was in a town in Giza, and it was just there were two families, one Christian, one Muslim, and they over the shirt that was accidentally burned, there became insults and insults hurled back and forth, and all of a sudden it escalated into this cascading violence between Muslims and Christians that certainly showed right underneath how sensitive things are underneath the surface.
Well, a man was killed.
A gas bomb was killed. A firebomb was thrown from a roof, and a young Muslim man was killed, and that set the tensions off. Incited even more.
Well, you quote a Muslim car dealer in the town, standing near a mosque, watching things going on, saying there was nothing wrong before this mistake of someone scorching someone's shirt. Before this, Christians and Muslims were brothers, and now a huge problem has fallen on our doorstep. Is that true?
It's true to an extent. In many cases, throughout the centuries, Coptic Christians and Muslims have coexisted fine. But there have been flashpoints throughout history. And since the fall of Mubarak, Coptic Christians in the Christian community have become increasingly wary and increasingly threatened in some instances by radical Islamists, by Salafis and others who've put pressure on them. So it's a give and take, and in that case, it was just an incident too far.
We want to pick up, you mentioned Salafis, we want to pick that up, but there's a lot else going on. Cross undercurrents. There's poverty. There's, right. Disappointing government. There's dirty drinking water, power outages. Right. This is sort of the time of frustration, it would seem, after the honeymoon.
Yes, exactly. I think everything right now has to be looked in a much broader context. You have a revolution in Egypt that went for 18 days. It was this beautiful, glorious thing. Mubarak was gone, and the Egyptians were ready to move on. But then they ran into a government run by the military. Then they ran into parliamentary elections, and their parliament was taken away. One event after another seemed to diminish the hope that came with the revolution. Now they're facing serious economic consequences. All the things that they hope were leading to dignity have been stripped away in many ways in their own country. Then comes this video that is perceived around the world as being anti-Islamic, and it's just another degradation they face, and it almost provided an outlet to let out the steam, and that was able to.
In other words, the video provided the outlet that the scorched shirt did in that little town.
Right. It's a similar dynamics, larger issues boiling underneath that do it. But what's happening? I think we look at it, two-track things. What's happening is there is an unfinished. We tend to look at the West tends to look at Islam as a battle between Islam and the West. Why can't we see eye to eye? There is the larger unresolved question in Islam between moderates and ultra-conservatives of what political Islam is going to look like. And until that debate wrinkles out and smooths, then we're going to continue to have this.
Well, you're speaking along the lines of that Salman Sheikh, who's director of the Brookings Doha Center in Qatar, did when he said, yes, there's some latent anti-Americanism that's coming out here, no question about that, two wars in the region, drone strikes. But he says that's only a part of this. This is primarily a struggle for the soul of these states.
I think to some extent, certainly it is. When you're in Egypt and you see the political dynamics unfolding, the Muslim Brotherhood is essentially a moderate party, but some of its leaders are very conservative leaning. Then you go further to the conservative spectrum, and you have the Salafis. So you have this tug and pull of what is our constitution going to look like? How are we going to infuse Islam into public life, and what does that mean? And for some, the Quran is the constitution, and there is no separation between that and civil society.
So you say the Salafis are to the right of the Muslim Brotherhood, which some say is a group that has been moderated over the last decade. Tell us more about the Salafis. Ultra-conservative, active not only in Egypt but in Syria, Tunisia, where they've attacked businesses selling alcohol. You know, how do Salafis relate to Muslim Brotherhood, to Al-Qaeda? Who are they?
Salafis are the conservatives. They're not organized in any structural sense. They follow different imams and teachers and preachers, but they're certainly ultra-conservative, puritanical, and they derive everything from the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet. So they don't see a separation between Islam and civil society, and they're willing to go right to, if offended, especially in religious terms, they're willing to go right to the streets, as they've done.
Well, what do they represent, though? You know, is this just the shakeout from a revolution? The U.S., we were talking before we went on the air here, the U.S. saw spasms of violence against blacks after the Civil War for over 100 years. You know, is this just history's losers, you know, not giving up the fight easily, or is there something more here?
It's something more. It's a shaking out of who history winners are going to be, or who the current winners are going to be, and that's unresolved. And it's a real struggle. The brother of the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood told me late last year that Islam is yet to go through a renaissance of what it wants to be when it governs, and how political Islam is articulated. And this battle between the two is unresolved. And then further afield, you have Al-Qaeda and the militants who are looking for opportunities to seize on this. And I think these current protests across the world now are a combination of all these factors commingling, being co-opted by some who want to keep the anti-Americanism alive, being co-opted by others who want to keep pressure on local police forces because they don't like them. And look at the men throwing rocks. They're young, angry, unemployed men who have found no sense of hope yet in the revolutions that promise so much.
That's Jeffrey Fleischman, Cairo Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, in our studios today. We'll link you to his article about the Christian dry cleaner and the Muslim client whose shirt was mistakenly scorched, and how that incident inflamed a village. When we come back, given those tensions, what can the Obama administration do? Anything? Maybe not. Or what hasn't it done that Jeffrey thinks it should? That's in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Jeffrey Fleischman, Cairo Bureau Chief of the Los Angeles Times, here in Boston today, reflecting on tensions in the Arab world in the wake of that film that mocked the Prophet Muhammad, and long before it, tensions in Egypt, for instance, between Muslims and Coptic Christians, who make up only 10% of that population. We're also wondering, how does what's happening now fit into the Arab Spring? And Jeffrey, on that line, what would you say to critics of the Obama administration who say the West was foolish to applaud these revolutions? I'm thinking of people like Michelle Bachmann, Sarah Palin, who never thought the Arab Spring was a good thing. They always saw this as an opening for conservative forces to take over.
If you look at how American foreign policy is viewed from Cairo or from Tunis or from Sana'a, Yemen, you're looking at a Muslim world that sees the U.S. against them all the time and holding up dictators and autocrats like Mubarak and Ben Ali in Tunisia. And all of a sudden that broke, and American foreign policy, many would say in that region, reacted too late to embracing what was going on.
But it ultimately did.
It ultimately did.
Is it not getting any points for that now?
I'm sure that's what people in the White House are saying. What the heck? We did this, and this, and we're still behind it. But I think it goes to, again, to the fundamental thing of a cultural misunderstanding. The Muslim world, whether it's moderate, liberal, or ultra-conservative like the Salafis, the Prophet is sacrosanct. To the Muslim world, it's like in the U.S. attacking free speech. It's a thing that glues them together, even though they have different divisions on other things.
So what are you saying? Is it the film? Because, you know, the grand debate has been raging, you know, whether or not it was the film that unleashed all this violence, or whether all this violence, as even you said, all this violence was just close to the surface and it would have taken any small thing to unleash it. What are you saying? Was it the film primarily?
The film was something that was collectively seen in the world, in the Muslim world, as an affront to Islam, and was a conduit that all these things could coalesce under and
all these
and
other
ignite
problems.
Under. Right. And then there were different manipulators behind each one of them, you know, angling for their own agendas, and I think it all came together. But it does go to show you how much is just under the surface, and the major problems it presents for the Obama administration right now.
Well, and what does happen now? By the way, it's worth pointing out that the man said to be behind the anti-Muslim, anti-Islam film is a Coptic Christian living in California. You started by telling us the story of how a Coptic Christian family had mistakenly, accidentally scorched the shirt of a Muslim man, and how that set off, a mini conflagration in this one village. You described this one village as now, surrounded by Egyptian troops and detectives who are keeping the peace, and Muslims who are helping protect Coptic Christian homes. I mean, if you extrapolate that out broader, you can't have troops trying to keep the peace in every town. What happens now?
Well, in that town, it was the microcosm, because the Muslim Brotherhood and President Mohamed Morsi of Egypt, I think his administration realized this is a flashpoint. We've seen it, so immediately troops were dispatched, many more police trucks than you might have even seen under former President Hosni Mubarak.
And to help these Christians and Muslims that side by side.
And also for Egypt's international reputation. I mean, here's a country, facing an enormous financial problems, needing international monetary fund loans, needing Western support. They couldn't be perceived again as conflict between Christians and Muslims to the West where it needs help. So that's another line that side of the government is walking.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I was going over old newspapers before today and came across an article from just a couple weeks ago about how the Obama administration was debating this huge aid package that it was going to give to Egypt.
Right.
So there's much in the balance there. But then, you know, given that this is what happened in that one town, you had a great quote from a police officer about this, what the town is going through now, you know, all the security, people trying to, you know, maintain calm. He says, imagine when you're sick and you have to stay in bed. That's what our town is going through now. It's a town that's literally seeing itself as emotionally sick and having to stay in bed and stay inside and
recover from this.
Yeah.
When we were talking to that police officer, he's surrounded by police trucks and riot police, but he didn't want to concede that there was a problem there. And then finally, he chose this euphemism, which I think he wanted to soften it, but it showed the glaring tensions that were there.
And is the region? Is the region ill right now? Is the region does the region have to?
I think the region right now is struggling for its post-revolution identity. And every time it looks to do that, something else happens that are the larger pressures facing any society: the economy, social unrest, crime in Egypt. It is up now. If you talk to most Egyptians, many of the times, Islam and their religion, they're fine with that. That's not the problem. They're looking into the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and saying, I want a job. I want tourists to come back. Religion and those who manipulate it can take advantage of certain things, but the masses are looking for some type of redemption, political redemption, and to get their lives back on track.
So, Jeffrey, given the tensions that you talked about between Christians and Muslims, between Muslims and, you know, more conservative Muslims, more moderate Muslims, between the Muslim world and the Western world, two ongoing wars, drone strikes, you know, the list goes on. What would your criticism of the Obama administration be? You've already said that there's a perception in Egypt, and it was widespread, that the Obama administration was slow to react to the revolution, but that when it did, it supported it. But if that's just a perception, Can the Obama administration do public relations to override that? What could be done?
They've offered to forgive a $1 billion loan to the Egyptians. They're giving $1.3 billion a year in military aid. They're giving other aid. But for some reason, the perception on the other side is it's not enough, or some on the ultra-conservatives don't want any of it at all, saying we should go it alone. Moderates say, wait a minute, we can't go it alone. We need help. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's a tug and pull between them about how they want to accept Western help or what that form of diplomacy might be. And that's where I think Washington is stuck.
That's Jeffrey Fleischman, Cairo bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. And so he's been giving us some terrific insight into what's going on in the region. But, Jeffrey, we also understand your new book, a novel, is the story of a journalist whose early onset Alzheimer's has taken most of his memories.
Yes. Yeah.
Frightening.
Yes, it is frightening.
Well, we'll have an excerpt at herenow.org, and we recommend it as we do your other books as well. Jeffrey, always good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And as we try to sort all this news out, tomorrow we're going to speak with a Boston doctor who was in Benghazi the day the consulate was attacked and Christopher Stevens, the ambassador, killed. He was there to work with Stevens. We'll find out why tomorrow. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu. And by the Institute of Contemporary Art, featuring the glass sculptures of Josiah McElhaney, on view now through October 14th, icaboston.org.